Professor Abbott.
Let's welcome him.
Thank you very much.
First, I extend my thanks to the organizers of this very important conference on very important subject matter, and it's a pleasure to be here with you. My undergraduate thesis on the Andean Pact technology transfer regime was written in 1973. Professor Shan mentioned to me that he was born in 1970, so in fact I have not been working on this since before he was born, but since he was 3 years old. My talk today has less to do, I think, with the rule of law as such and more to do with the limits of the rule of law, and perhaps particularly with the limits of the rule of law within the current structure of the WTO system. What I'm going to talk to you about is a fairly complex subject matter. I don't have time to go through really everything I have prepared in 25 or 30 minutes. So I'll try to hit the highlights. I may challenge the translators. But with that, I will begin. To remind you, the establishment of the WTO, and particularly the negotiation of the TRIPS agreement, was in many ways a reaction to the demands by the Group of 77 and other developing countries in the late 60s and the 1970s for the establishment of a new international economic order. And the reaction of the United States, Europe, and Japan was instead to demand higher standards of intellectual property protection rather than advancing transfer of technology in the interests of development. The TRIPS agreement, of course, establishes minimum substantive standards. It says very little, really very little, about transfer of technology obligations. And so that's the background with which we're working. I would say in the meantime, with a long historical arc, in 1989 we had the collapse of the Soviet Union, China joined the WTO. In 2001, and for a variety of reasons which we'll get into, has emerged as a major economic power. And so in the international economic system, we no longer have this idea of a neat division between high-income countries and low- and middle-income countries. We have a spectrum of development, and we can debate where people fit along that chain. Much of what we've been talking about so far is that as of today, we've seen a devolution in the international economic system toward nationalism. None of us know whether that's a long-term or a transitory phenomenon. I think we could all say, maybe not all, but fragmentation of the international economic system is not a good thing, not only because we move away from the global production possibility frontier, which is an economic concept, but the whole reason we had the GATT and the WTO was a reaction to the events preceding the Second World War and the tendencies towards nationalism and violence, and so we embodied this multinational system to move away from that. So that's the risk. It may not at the moment seem like a big risk, but it is a risk. A basic thesis of the paper I prepared for the conference is that China's success as an emerging economic power did not depend on following the rules of the WTO and the TRIPS agreement, nor did it depend on rejecting or flouting those rules. China has succeeded in its development because of its characteristics as a country and its economic circumstances, and very sophisticated government planning in promoting the development of the economy to take advantage of those characteristics. I noted in a book I wrote about China's accession in 1998 that inevitably China's accession to the WTO would make it a less comfortable place for the United States, the European Union, and Japan, and it's no surprise that it has turned out that way. It also is true that the path China has taken may be different than what the US and the EU expected. But finally, we always should expect that these arrangements have to be adjusted over time. Particularly, we've had tremendous technological transformation over the past 30 years. Let me go back one. So what was it that made China successful? I'm not going to walk through all of these, but if we look back, you know, a large population, a major low-wage labor pool, started with a weak IP system, which allowed technological leapfrogging and so forth, initially tolerated some environmental harm. Today's China is very different. That large population is now perceived as an attractive consumer market. You're integrated in supply chains. The IP system has been dramatically strengthened. And so when the United States and Europe and the companies say that China has a weak IP system today, I would challenge that. I think today China, if anything, is at risk of overprotection through granting too many patents and is dramatically improving enforcement. So I'm not so inclined on the weak IP system anymore. The government engages in detailed planning. And you've got economic and military power, and those are both important components because you can resist third country pressure. So today China is really graduating from a technology importing country. I would say maybe today China's a technology neutral country, but it's moving to being a technology exporting country. And you see that, for example, just a few weeks ago it was reported that Huawei is beginning to assert its patent portfolio in the United States against U.S. companies, and this is going to be a new element. And there's various factors that are significant in current relations. We currently have a pushback, as you're familiar with, from the United States and the European Union. And again, it's very complex. There's a variety of factors having to do with it has a military strategic component. This morning there was discussion of steel and whether that goes into military vehicles. But if you look at the assessments of the U.S. Department of Defense of the Pacific region, you can see that they have expressed significant concerns about how the balance of power is changing in the Pacific region. U.S. and European companies have a history of transferring technology willingly to the Chinese market in order to take advantage of the market. You have some non-traditional licensing conditions. You're much more active now in competition enforcement. There's allegations of forced technology transfer. We'll revert to that. Alleged cyber intrusion. And as I noted, Chinese companies are beginning to enforce abroad. We could spend an afternoon on each of these bullet points, really, but just to discuss that these matters, you have to be taken in their context. So I think just Uli mentioned, the U.S. trade sanctions on technology with China may be a positive from China's standpoint. It's a forced decoupling. And you can already see that in China, Huawei and others saying, well, we can't depend on Google's operating system anymore and so forth, so we have to develop our own systems. And this may turn out in the long run to have been a good thing from the Chinese standpoint. From my own personal standpoint, the idea of the Trump administration that pushing back against China is going to derail its progress towards technological parity, I've labeled as far-fetched. I mean, it might slow down a bit, but China is today a technology power, and it will continue to be a technology power regardless of what the United States does or doesn't do. What may, of course, happen is reallocation of export markets. Again, a complicated subject. On the question of IP, I mean, it's treated a little bit by President Trump and the administration like this is something that just came up yesterday. And this is really kind of a strange perspective. Really, since the very opening of the Chinese market in the late 1980s, the U.S. has been pushing, the EU has been pushing China on IP matters. You had bilateral agreements in the very early 1990s. These were negotiated heavily during the accession protocol negotiations. The United States had an action against China in the China enforcement case, which has taught a number of lessons in this area. Every year since my memory dates back, the U.S. has been criticizing China in its special 301 reports on intellectual property, and we've had various commissions and working groups over the years addressing these issues. So to say that for some reason 6 months ago or a year ago, transfer of technology in China suddenly became an issue is just a bit of a strange view of history. This has been a substantive matter of negotiation since the late 1980s, and we're just looking at part of a fairly long historical arc. Again, a lot more could be said about history, but we're very time constrained. Now, if you look at the principal foundation of U.S. current complaints about China, they go to the 2018 Section 301 finding. Now, that's a very interesting report, and one of the principal things to highlight for present purposes is the USTR did not rely on those parts of Section 301 which talk about China or the other country violating a legal norm. In this case, not violating a WTO legal norm or the TRIPS agreement. It specifically relied on the parts of Section 301 which allow the United States to take legal action because we deem, unilaterally deem, the other country to be acting unreasonably with or discriminatorily with respect to the United States' interests, even if the other country is complying with the TRIPS agreement. Now, one of the implications of that, and we had discussion of the 301 case earlier, is that if USDR said, and it's within the WTO ambit, then by necessity, looking at the 301 case, we'd have to bring those disputes to the WTO. Not that we necessarily would, but in principle we would need to. But we've said that they aren't part of the WTO orbit, and therefore in principle we don't need to bring them. Now that has some important consequences when we get back to the protocol of accession analysis, which we'll get to in a minute. Now, one thing I should mention, a small part of the report had to do with some Chinese licensing practices, and I won't detail them. For example, requiring patentees to indemnify licensees in the event of an infringement proceeding, and so forth. But the main allegation there was that China was treating foreign nationals differently than Chinese nationals. So it was a national treatment issue. It wasn't that the conditions themselves were illegal, but a national treatment issue. The U.S. has suspended the complaint. I'm implying that China has maybe agreed to remove the national treatment discrimination. But in any case, this was a small matter. I mean, this didn't rise to we're going to have a trade war over it. The main allegations of the findings are that the Chinese government at the national and subnational level forces U.S. companies approaching China for foreign direct investment to transfer technology to Chinese enterprises, and that this is an off-the-record type of negotiation. There is no paper trail. It's much in the nature of collusion in an antitrust context. And part of the problem in this whole area is that the multinational companies based in the United States are unwilling to go on record as to what the Chinese government is doing because in their terms, they fear retaliation. So we're kind of stuck without information, and this was a problem in the China enforcement case. Now, we'll get now to the key point, and this goes into the accession protocol and the rules. The WTO agreement, including the TRIPS agreement, are not investment agreements as such. They are trade in goods agreements, and also the TRIPS agreement being an IP agreement. And the TRIMS agreement, trade-related investment measures, discusses not imposing requirements on companies as a condition of allowing imported products into the country, for example, requiring that a certain amount of components be produced locally or that a certain amount of technology be transferred to a local company as a condition of importation. The TRIMS agreement is not a direct investment agreement. The main complaints of the U.S. about China are about direct investment, conditions on investing in the Chinese market and requiring the transfer of technology. Now, as it turns out, and I'm not going to go into Peter van de Bosch type of analysis here because that alone would take all afternoon, but you have paragraph 7.3 of China's accession protocol, which references transfer of technology in the context of TRIMS. And then if you look initially in its complaint, the U.S. didn't cite the Working Party report. In the EU's amended complaint against China, it finally cites the Working Party report. I don't know why it didn't do that in the first place. But in any event, paragraphs 49 and 203 of the Working Party report, which are incorporated by reference, are part of Chinese commitments. Now, here you have a case of at least an arguable ambiguity. And I'm not going to parse the syntax here again because it's complex and would take too long. But the real question is whether the final sentence when China discusses investment, whether that's intended to create a self-standing obligation regarding investment as such, or whether it relates back to the TRIPS and TRIMS conditions, which are not, in fact, conditions on investment as such. So the key question looked at from, let's say, a global standpoint is whether by including the final sentence of the Working Party Protocol paragraph, the parties intended and or China intended to be converting the WTO agreements into a foreign direct investment agreement instead of being a trade and goods agreement, and how the WTO, let us say, if the appellate body's functioning, would eventually interpret that provision. And I'm not going to express a firm opinion about that. But I'm a little bit on the other side of, let's call it, current mainstream Western economic thought or international legal thought. When we talk about forced technology transfer, China is a big and very valuable market. When a U.S. company approaches to invest in China, China is offering access to this large and valuable market. The U.S. company wants entry into the market, and what China may want to bargain for is transfer of technology in the context of whether or not that investment should be made. And I don't speak here only about China. I would almost forget about China. It applies to any country in the process of development. You're offering access to your market in return for what? Only providing low-wage labor source? You may also bargain for technology. So, as a developmental matter, I don't regard bargaining for transfer of technology as a bad policy option. Now, the U.S. and the EU come back and say, well, you may be right, but still, if you want to export to our market, you have to concede on that point. So it may be perfectly legitimate for you to condition the investment on transfer of technology, but at the same time, we can make conditions applicable to you, which will be the reciprocal bargain. And so, as a matter of principle, I'm not so keen on this forced technology transfer business, but as again, I say that doesn't reflect, for example, the views of the US government. Another major matter in the complaint situation, again, for reasons of time, I just have to flip through it, is allegations of cyber piracy. And here we're talking really about theft of trade secrets through mainly, but not exclusively, through digital penetration of networks. And there's allegations in the USTR finding that these practices are taking place through including Chinese government agencies, which then provide the technology to the domestic companies. Now, to be clear, TRIPS has a lot of flexibilities, but it doesn't have cyber theft as one of its flexibilities. And at the same time, China has never conceded that its companies or its military engage in those practices, nor has it suggested that those practices are condoned by international law. So we do have provisions relating to trade secrets, Articles 39.1 and two, that require protection of trade secrets. So if you're in the United States and you find a Chinese company has penetrated the network, you could bring an action in the United States against the Chinese company for doing that. The problem is, if it's a penetration originating in Guangzhou, you're going to have a lot of trouble prosecuting someone from Guangzhou in the United States. And if it's something that's done by a government agency, it becomes even much more difficult to discover in the first place, and prosecuting it becomes highly improbable. And the additional problem is with technology. Once the firewall has been breached and the technology has been appropriated, you can levy a fine, but you can't get the technology back, right? I mean, it's gone. So it's a serious problem, and I wouldn't underestimate that, leaving WTO members, like the United States, with not too many legal options to address cyber piracy, including in the WTO context. And this is a significant feature of the so-called trade war. A logical solution would be to have an international agreement which banned the practice in an enforceable way. That's a very tough challenge at the moment. We're almost stuck in a situation where countries are probably going to start reciprocally escalating their cyber piracy attacks just to prove to one another that they better stop. But that's another question. Another major part of the findings, this is the last part of the findings I'll discuss, was China Made in China 2025 program. Now, of course, you can immediately see the irony of the United States criticizing China for having a program for global production and technological superiority, since President Trump's program is exactly local production and technological superiority. So, but if we leave the kind of irony of the situation aside, it's a bit strange, really, to criticize a government for planning, right? I mean, to planning that we prefer to have environmentally sound products, or we prefer to have a healthcare system that can provide relatively inexpensive medicines, new biologic medicines, improve R&D, and so forth. You have to look at the contrary argument. The government really just shouldn't plan. They should just let people run off and do whatever they want, and whatever the outcome is what you'd expect. So I don't think we want a rule that says don't plan. I think I would prefer for people to be thinking and planning. But that then leaves you with the problem. So what happens if the government subsidizes, right? That's one way or another, through tax or direct financial incentives. Well, there we have WTO agreements that are designed to deal with, because who's hurt by that? Well, if China subsidizes the development of an electric automobile, and we're all better off because of that, who's hurt? Well, maybe European auto manufacturers. So they face some market displacement. So how do you remedy the market displacement? And the way you do that is with some form of countervailing duties. So we've been dealing with that for a long time in the WTO. I just mentioned that because we face a real conundrum. We need governments to plan. Otherwise, we have carbon emissions, global warming, inadequate health care. The subsidies agreement used to have, a long time ago, an R&D exception. Again, ideally, we could negotiate our way out of this box, but remember that the GATT had a committee on trade and environment. They talked about this since the beginning of time. Even in the shrimp turtle case, the appellate body said, well, it would be nice if someone had thought this through and worked out a solution for us, but they can't, or they haven't, so we need to kind of try to address it ourselves. And one option, I just throw that out there, is you can have something that says if your R&D is subsidized and you develop a solution, then you have to grant a license to third countries and have them pay you a fair royalty, and then you could all produce the good. So there's various things you could think of. So what are we facing, right? We're facing, and I refer to an old book by Olivier Long, Long Its Limitations in the GATT Multilateral Trading System, where he pointed out that then the GATT, but now the WTO, it doesn't cover everything. And in some cases, it really isn't in a position to constrain the exercises of governmental power. And also, things change. I mean, when the Uruguay round was negotiated, literally 1986 to 1993, the internet really wasn't even a thing at that point. I mean, only in the early 90s was it even something worth talking about. So it's not surprising that the agreements, in that sense, are a bit outmoded. I don't think that things at the in the multilateral system really are going to settle down until the politicians and diplomats really come to some understanding about what new rule sets should look like. Bear in mind, and Ollie may have mentioned this, or Peter, I mean, we've been discussing WTO reform for many, many years. The Doha round was a 19-year experiment and failure. I mean, I'm not sure we've even agreed that it's over yet formally, but really it accomplished very little. And one of the areas where we've seen the most extra WTO negotiation, agreement, dispute has been in these areas of intellectual property, transfer of technology, and so forth, where governments have been felt they are compelled to act. They can't work in an environment where they're not developing new rules. And current controversies are broadly reminiscent, really, of the events preceding the Uruguay round. So again, the most productive approach may be to sit back, I'm not sure we have a choice. While the political branches work out a new steady state or stasis with some type of new rules that may need enforcement, legal rules and enforcement are needed. Just a very short conversion. One of the big initial problems and continuing problems with the TRIPS agreement was it was a one-size-fits-all, largely, agreement. In the technology arena, countries are in very different circumstances. So it's very difficult to say, we're going to have one body of rules that's going to apply to everybody, and that's going to meet everybody's interest. So it's not entirely unlikely that we're going to need to have alternative fora, whether they're multilateral, regional, plurilateral, and so forth. And it may be that the WTO dispute settlement body isn't the right place to resolve disputes. We may be looking at bilateral commissions. We may be looking at regional dispute settlement arrangements. We may be looking at arrangements where a commission could award monetary damages for breaches and other alternative arrangements. It's not a knock by any means on the WTO dispute settlement system or the appellate body, but transfer of technology and IP are highly specialized, complex areas where different rules benefit in one way or another different countries in different ways, and we may need to, as I say, think outside the box in terms of how we're going to resolve these issues. So I thank you very much.